Hey, for those of you who haven't figured it out, we had a last minute cancellation. Thaisa Carvalho-Mick, who was supposed to be our speaker tonight, texted me about, I don't know, 15 minutes ago and said she's in the ER with a really bad UTI, and she can't come tonight. So she's going to come back in 2 weeks, to talk about what she learned about, civil commitment facilities, shadow prisons. And tonight, I actually had this on my list of things that I kind of wanted us to do at a war room anyway, because I thought it was a really excellent interview. And it's really, I think it's really important to our, people, just understanding how probation and parole has gone crazy and is unhelpful to everyone. So I actually had this on the list of things to do next week or 2 weeks from now. So I'm basically just swapping the July 2nd for the June 18th. It was really hard getting anybody who was willing to come on July 2nd.
Which of these is this? It
The
didn't go
pot.
directly to a recording.
It didn't.
No.
That is weird. Oh, you're right. It didn't. Okay, hang on. Let me see. You're right. It didn't. Okay, hang on a second. Let me find it in my email.
And while you're doing that, I'm going to look at my audio settings.
Ooh. Okay, see if that next one works, because the next one wasn't just think, it was this particular episode.
You sent me a new link.
Yep, I put it in the chat. Okay, for those of you who are just getting here, if you haven't checked your email, I'm really sorry, but the lady who was supposed to come on today, Thaisa Carvalho-Mick, texted me like 20 minutes ago saying she's in the ER with a really bad UTI, getting fluids. And so I'm going to switch her for, I was going to do the thing I'm doing right now next Tuesday, July 20, I mean, Tuesday, July 2nd. And so I'm going to just switch. Vincent Schiraldi is way too popular to come on my dumb little war room. But he was on NPR and had a really good episode about probation and parole and how dumb it is. And so we're going to play that and discuss it tonight. It's about a 45-minute conversation he has on NPR, and then we'll have 45 minutes to talk about it. So I'm really sorry, but no Thaisa today. And everybody, send her your best wishes as she gets poked with needles and tests at the hospital. Josh was here. Anyway, right now we're trying to figure out the details of how to play this episode from NPR show Think, where Vince Schiraldi went on to the NPR show and had a conversation about his book. His book is called Mass Incarceration, or no, Mass Supervision, How Probation and Parole, something about, I don't know, something about how it's dumb and bad. So I think it's going to be a good conversation, but it's not going to be the conversation about civil commitment that we thought it would be because Tice is in the hospital.
Wait, did you say Thaisa is in the hospital?
Yeah, she texted me 20 minutes ago and said she's in the hospital. She's got a really bad UTI, and she's got dehydration, and her body's going into septic shock. So not good, very not good.
Thank you for letting me know. She's somebody I care deeply about.
Yeah, ditto. Anyway, she says she's got a friend. She's in the city that she works at, not the city where she lives. So she's an hour from home, but she has a friend picking her up. And she's going to let her stay with her after they're released, but they're still running tests. So yeah, send her some
Just that you.
positive vibes. Hospitals are so difficult. Anyway, so Chuck, are you having any luck with that link?
Putting up with some ads. Second.
Okay, that may happen. Yep, there we go. Thank you, Jeannie Mesger. It's called
How good is that audio?
a school that provides tutors to help students struggling with.
It's not great, but it's hearable.
Sessions meant to help students succeed. Any grammar or spelling mistakes they make must be reported to their regular teacher, who must
Yeah,
punish them for the mistake.
that's fine.
Or worse yet, imagine
Is
a
it?
tutor has the power to.
I can hear words coming out. I don't know if they're the words you're intending to play, but it was something about students, and I've already forgotten. It didn't sound like Vince Giraldi, but it was loud enough to hear, so I think that should work. Could everybody else hear what he was just playing? All right, Jane says yes. John says yes. Joshua says yes. So I
This
think
is
that could
Mellow.
work.
This is Mellow Harperstadt. This is my first time.
Hi, Mello.
Hi.
I'm really sorry, those of you who are just getting on. About 20 minutes ago, I had a call from, or a text message from the woman who is supposed to be our speaker tonight, Thaisa Carvalho-Mick. She's in the hospital at the moment. She's in the ER. She's got a really bad UTI that's turned into possibly septic shock. So she canceled. Wow. She canceled, obviously.
Okay.
And she said she could come back, assuming she, you know, is healthy in 2 weeks. She could come back on July 2nd. So I'm going to just switch her for the show I was planning on July 2nd. I was already planning to do this mass supervision conversation because I listened to it on NPR and it was just really good, really good interview. And Vincent Schiraldi is way too fancy to say yes to coming on my little war room.
Wow.
But I think it's really good information. And so we're going to do it today instead of 2 weeks from now. So I totally understand anyone who came just for the civil commitment conversation. That's not going to be what we're having today. So if you need to drop off, I totally get it. But the hope is that she'll be all healed up and she'll come back on July 2nd to talk to us about her fascinating 5 months inside one of those shadow prisons.
Yeah, I've seen her, a video of her doing that message. I've already seen that. So
thank you for watching.
I watched it.
That was me. Yeah.
Was that you?
Yeah, yeah. I'm the one that, yeah. That's why I said she's my friend. I care about her a lot because I had to stop doing the interviews because of my tremors. That started with my last civil commitment.
I understand that.
Troubling stories. But this one, for some reason, this is not about me. I apologize. But I was the one that did the interview with her, and it's very powerful, and it was very brave.
It is. And it was.
She's gone through hell because she did that interview. She called me begging to remove the interview multiple times because of the attacks on her family, her career. She sacrificed and lost a lot on behalf of civil commitment, as everyone mm-hmm. who's been in this fight can attest to. So it's not easy. It takes a lot of courage. So please, everyone, pray for her and every single person who's fighting against them, because it's not
easy. And not only that, she says Larned, which is the shadow prison she was working at, mm-hmm. Filed complaints against her. And now that her licensing board is causing struggle for her. So, you know, the fact that she was fighting against this awful system is maybe costing her her licensure.
I want to say this because I'm going to leave because I can't, all the voices would be bad for my tremors, but I wanted to be here to support her. But we just published a book from Mark Brule, who is in Laren, Kansas. He's telling his story. It's called Suffer Me Greatly. You all should check it out if you want to know a lot about civil commitment. It gets into his life story, but also he talks about the horrors that happened there. And he wants to go back to federal prison because that would be a vacation compared to civil commitment. But that said, he's telling a story. So there's, and what that'll do, and the reason I'm bringing it up is it will confirm everything that Thaisa is saying also. Because
yes, exactly.
Up.
We need her.
Yeah.
Yeah. We sure
God
do.
God bless you all. Keep up the good fight. And rooting for all of you and all of your missions.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this book before we leave? I'm trying to find it on the internet.
It's on Amazon, but I'm actually getting ready to publish it directly on my website so he can make more money and not have to split with Amazon. I published his book for free. I edited it and wrote the forward and created a new cover for him. And because I can't do interviews, I'm not out of the fight, but I'm fighting smarter and I'm fighting in ways that can't be censored. And that's through publishing. So I'm publishing all of the prisoners' books that want to write books to get their stories out. In fact, if any of you family, if you're a loved one of someone who's gone through civil commitment and you want to get your book out, I'm more than happy to publish it for you. I don't charge. It's so easy to do now. It would be stupid to charge, but we have to fight through the media and independent media shows like this and what you're doing on the war room are so important. Independent voices matter. All of your voices matter. All of them need to be heard. And sometimes with interviews and things like that, you can get censored or get shut down and deplatformed. I went through all that. But the thing is about publishing from your own website, your own platforms, and also publishing books, that is almost it's a very hard weapon to censor, because a book can be distributed a lot of different ways. And so that's something I'm doing for any of the prisoners, because these voices have got to get out. They got
to
get out.
You want to put a link to your website in our chat so people can find it?
Sure. That's fine. That would be awesome. It's a private chat.
Oh, Chuck, can you change it so that everybody can message the whole group?
Oh.
For some reason, it always defaults to you can only message the speaker or the...
Okay, it should be everyone now.
Okay. So you should be able to, that little blue box, you should be able to change it to say everyone.
And I have some of the civil commitment interviews and like Taiza, that's on there too. And I'm not trying to plug my stuff, but if you go under publishing, you'll see Mark's book. I'm getting ready tomorrow to build out where you can actually immersively read that book directly from the website, and it'll be much cheaper to get.
Oh.
Because when you direct publish and you don't have to share the money, you can keep your money, and it has better SEO implications anyway. That's a whole other conversation. We'll be able to make the book less money, but then Mark will be able to make more money to help fight for himself. So that's why we're doing it. So tomorrow it's going to look different, but it's on the publishing page. And check it out.
We click on this link, and then there'll be a sub tab, something.
Yeah, you'll see it at the very top. You'll see like the media company in a box. You'll see show stuff, but you'll see a section called publishing in Mark's books there. But I'm building out a whole page for him tomorrow. But right now, you'll still see his book there.
Okay.
And
all right. Well, thank you for coming, Joshua.
His story. His story needs to be heard, and it's really weird to say this, but it's almost a love story, and which is really strange, but like when you read the book, it is like it's hard to understand what is happening and like the realness of it. There's a lot going on, but it's a very powerful story, and it probably will be a movie one day, because I've never heard a story like this in my life, and everyone's story is unique, but it's really powerful, and it will help you get to understand a different perspective of how things like civil commitment happen and what happens to people that leads to some of the decisions that they make. It's a heartbreaking story. It's also inspiring, and it's kind of romantic in one of the weirdest ways I ever heard romance, but it's worth reading.
Wow, cool. All right, well, Okay. Thank you, Joshua.
Blessings all, thank you. That noise, ah!
Hang up. Okay, so I'm going to just tell everybody who's just getting here, in case you didn't check your email in the last half hour, about maybe a half an hour ago, I got a message from tonight's speaker saying that she's in the hospital, she's in the emergency room, she has a really bad UTI, and so she canceled for tonight. We're going to reschedule her for 2 weeks from tonight on July 2nd, and tonight I'm going to do what I was going to do on July 2nd, which is we're going to play an interview that Vincent Schiraldi gave on NPR about his book, Mass Supervision, Probation, Parole, and the Illusion of Safety and Freedom. It's a really good interview. So we're gonna play the interview for the first 45 minutes and then talk about it if we'd like to. So if you only came here to talk about civil commitment, I'm really sorry, but that's gotten moved back to 2 weeks from today. Of course, you're certainly welcome to stay and talk to us about mass supervision. I think this was a really excellent book, and I'm hoping we can get a good conversation out of it. Chuck, you're still working on figuring out how to make
this. Are you ready for it to go?
I don't know why not.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, 7:10. Hit it.
Here it goes.
A school that provides tutors to help students struggling with reading sounds like a good idea, but there's a catch in this hypothetical. Imagine that during these one-on-one sessions meant to help students succeed, any grammar or spelling mistakes they make must be reported to their regular teacher, who must punish them for the mistake. Or worse yet, imagine a tutor has the power to automatically require a student to repeat a year of school for showing up late, making a minor error, or failing to pay the tutor's salary. To my knowledge, there is no school that works this way because it's a bad idea. But this is exactly the kind of help we offer to millions of Americans in the probation and parole systems. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There's been surprising bipartisan support for policies designed to curb mass incarceration. But my guest would argue that shunting huge amounts of people into probation and parole programs is not a great alternative, and all the hoops people have to jump through may actually create crime. Vincent Schiraldi is founder of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice and the Justice Policy Institute. His new book is called Mass Supervision: Probation, Parole, and the Illusion of Safety and Freedom. Vinny, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
So this is an issue, I think, that has flown under the radar for a lot of people who do care about effective criminal justice, including you for a long time. How did you begin to realize how many problems were baked into the parole and probation systems we have in this country?
Well, really, for me, it was when I actually went to run one of the nation's largest probation departments in New York City and, you know, met with Mayor Bloomberg, interviewed with him, saw how little attention was paid to the department in a city that actually ran pretty well. I was really paying a lot of attention to criminal justice and juvenile justice issues, but probation was, to call it an afterthought would even be to elevate its status. It was really a non-thought. I got in there and started meeting with staff. The morale was terrible. There had been several suicides by staff who were, you know, feeling very much under pressure to revoke and incarcerate people for technical, non-criminal violations of probation. And it was one thing to see that, but it was another thing to see in a very vibrant city that had a lot of activism and resources and research around criminal justice, kind of nobody was paying attention. I felt I could have sleptwalked through that 4 years and no one would have noticed.
You actually sat in on court proceedings one day and saw a woman ask for a jail term instead of another shot at probation. What made for her being locked up for a short time preferable to being on probation for a longer time?
So yeah, I did a listening tour to find out what made my department tick. And when I went to the Manhattan office, they said, you know, there's a couple of cases being heard inside Judge So-and-so's court. Why don't we go in? It's a couple of our probation cases. So I went in, and it was this woman convulsed in tears, saying that she wanted to be revoked and sent to New York City's notorious Rikers Island jail because she just couldn't handle the requirements of probation. She had a four-year-old, for example. She was not allowed to bring her child to her meetings with her probation officer, which she had every week. She lived up in Harlem. The office was way downtown. So it took an hour and a half each way to get there, plus sometimes you'd wait several hours to see your PO, and she was running out of favors with her aunt, her mother, her grandmother, who were saying, take care of your own kid, I don't have the ability to do this anymore. And that, plus all the other requirements on probation, not stay out after curfew, not associate with someone else with a criminal record, other, you know, don't travel out of the county without permission. All these things started to weigh on her so much that Rikers seemed like the better option, and indeed, that is what the court did that day.
Before we get too far into this, we should probably cover the question of what the point is of parole and probation programs. What kinds of outcomes are they supposed to promote or prevent?
So probation and parole were both founded in the 1800s, right around 1841, 42, believe it or not, probation here in the United States, in Massachusetts, parole in Australia. And probation's a front-end program that was designed as an alternative to incarceration. You get it, at least theoretically, instead of incarceration, and it's supposed to help you turn your life around and reduce incarceration, and therefore, by helping you turn your life around, improve public safety. Parole is at the back end. You've done your time in prison. You have a flexible sentence, let's say 1 to 3 years. You meet with the parole board. They say you've done lots of programs. You've behaved well in prison. You get out at 1 year, but you still owe a couple of years of supervision on the back end. Both are conditional. Both are meant to help you, but they're conditional. And if you violate rules, presumably rules that were meant to relate to the two major goals, public safety and rehabilitation. If you violate those rules, you can be re-imprisoned. You can see early on that that was very rare. That rarely happened that a parole officer or probation officer would re-imprison somebody for a technical non-criminal act. As things got more and more risk-averse over time, and we became a more punitive society, technical violations for non-criminal acts became so prevalent that now a quarter of people entering the United States prison system, which is the largest in the world, enter not because they committed a new crime, but because they violated some rule of probation or parole that costs us almost $3 billion a year.
I want to talk a little more about the origin story of probation in the U.S. as an alternative to incarceration. Tell us about this philanthropist in Boston. I guess he made his fortune as a shoemaker and wanted to give back to his community. What kind of informal system did he set up?
Yes, that's John Augustus. He was a cobbler, right, a bootmaker, and he was also an alcoholic, so he was part of a temperance movement, and he wanted to give back. And so he started to go to the Boston courts and ask the judges if he could bail people out and work with them to rehabilitate them and then return them to court in better shape than presumably they were when the judge was seeing them, instead of them going to the House of Corrections, which was the jail in Boston. And so he did this on his own, started bailing people out initially. It became so popular, then he started recruiting other members of the temperance movement to be essentially voluntary probation officers with him. This was a disruptive act. You know, we talk a lot about disruptors today. John Augustus was an early disruptor. For example, the police and the court officers used to get paid per capita by how many people went to jail. So you'd get 75% if the person you arrested got convicted in jail. And so by doing this, Augustus was interrupting their source of funds. And they started to then schedule people they knew he was interested in for inconvenient times of day. So he'd have to sit around in court all day long waiting for his person to come up. So much so that his business suffered and he died penniless and his business went under. His cobbling business went under.
And in addition to these compromised motives that people may have had for sending individuals to prison, from the beginning, Augustus's idea was criticized as being, I guess, insufficiently punitive toward people who had indeed broken laws.
That's right. And this is where you sort of get into the struggle between, is this purely a punishment, or is it a punishment towards an end, and a sentence towards an end? Augustus's view, obviously, was that the goal, the end in mind, is a safer society and a rehabilitated person. For others, it was just sheer punishment, and if it is sheer punishment, well, then anything that ameliorates that is a slap on the wrist.
So, I know early criminal justice efforts were often based on at least the idea that time behind bars could be spent learning to be better people. The focus for reformers early on was less punishment than rehabilitation?
Early on, absolutely. Our systems, our penitentiary, right, where you go to make penitence, our juvenile system, which we created in the late 1800s in the United States, that spread throughout the world, and things like probation and parole were all founded upon notions of rehabilitation. Whether we ever truly delivered on those notions, I think, is a separate question, but there's no question that that was the foundation of what we were trying to do up until around the 1970s.
What changed in 1974 with the publication of this paper by, I gather, a little-known scholar named Robert Martinson?
So a number of things were going on in the 70s and the 60s, right? There was a lot of protests around civil rights, around the anti-war, people growing their hair long, smoking dope. All these cultural revolutions were occurring, and some of them were very in-your-face and very upsetting to the dominant power structure, to the older generation. And so the Republican Party, Richard Nixon and his colleagues, launched what they call a Southern strategy to peel away reliable Southern voters and Northern suburban voters from the Democratic Party. And John Ehrlichman, President Nixon's former assistant for domestic affairs, describes it this way. He said, the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did.
Wow.
And so, yeah, oh, it's pretty alarming that these folks were willing to say that. H.R. Holliman, his chief of staff, wrote, President Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. So sort of early dog whistle politics. I'm going to say crime and poverty. You know what I'm talking about. It's black people and hippies. And so into this sort of swirling set of social factors comes this little known researcher named Robert Martinson, who was sort of a junior researcher on an effort to research which programs work in prisons by New York State's Department of Corrections so that they could spend more money on the ones that work and spend less money on the ones that don't work. And the findings were equivocal. Many of the programs weren't funded adequately. Many of the research efforts weren't done well. And so the report got sort of tossed in a round file and left on its own, or so we thought. Years later, Martinson distilled this report into the conservative newspaper Public Interest, and then it got kind of republished as what works when it comes to incarcerating people, and the answer was nothing works. And so now you have this whole sort of set of factors where there's a need to vilify and to politicize and to racialize criminal justice policies. And that's a seemingly hard piece of research that says nothing works when it comes to rehabilitating people. And these factors collide, and it marks really the beginning of the death of rehabilitation as a goal in criminal justice in America and the launch of our efforts to mass incarceration. So from when Nixon declares the war on drugs in 1972, the following year, 1973, 50 years ago, we begin an increase in incarceration, and we go from having a pretty typical incarceration rate to one that is 5, 7, sometimes 10 times our Western allies. And alongside this growth in prison is a growth in parole and probation, which you would not expect if there were true alternatives to incarceration. If there were true alternatives, when they went up, incarceration should go down. When they go down, incarceration should go up. The fact that they all went up together show that they are really an add-on and an increase in surveillance rather than a true alternative.
All right, Vinny, as you mentioned, this report by Robert Martinson that said nothing works to rehabilitate people in the criminal justice system, this pretty much killed efforts to rehabilitate. Martinson himself, though, kind of reversed his position on that a few years later, but I guess by that point the cat was not only out of the bag, but across the street and down the, you know, down the road.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's a lesson for us in all of this for today, as we sort of hype up our discussion about crime and punishment again with, you know, these increases in crime since the pandemic, as to, you know, where this kind of stuff can take us. Martinson said basically that his study actually didn't show that nothing works, that some programs actually did work, but nobody really listened to that because it didn't go along the grain of the mood of the country. And so very often we're willing to just go with the mood rather than where the data takes us. The important thing about this now for probation and parole, which is different from corrections, because I've run a probation department, also ran a New York City Department of Correction, Rikers Island, is a very different experience for the two different kind of departments. If you run a prison system or a jail system and rehabilitation is dead, well, you still have your market share. In fact, you might have a greater market share because you are meeting out punishment you are meeting out incapacitation, and you are meeting out deterrence. All those things still fit quite well with a prison system without much of a change. But if you run in probation and parole, pretty much the largest thing you do is help rehabilitate people. So what do you have if rehabilitation is dead, if it doesn't work? And so the whole field pivots at that time and becomes much more surveillance focused, starts loading people down with dozens of conditions that are very difficult, particularly for poor people, to meet, and develops a hair trigger back to incarceration for missteps, large and small.
So you write in the book that although it might be easy to, you know, blame the shortcomings of parole and probation on the officers hired to do this work, many of them really care about doing a good job for their clients and their communities. But talk a little bit about what is required of folks who are enrolled in these supervision programs. What are some of the rules that parole and probation officers are required by law to enforce?
So I'll give you a couple of examples, and maybe if it's okay, I'll tell you a story or two. So one is you can't stay out past a curfew, right? Again, seemingly reasonable thing, arguably anyway. So I meet one guy, I speak on a panel with him, who was referred to a job program by his parole officer. He goes there to get him a good job, but it's an evening job. It's a tech job, and it pays well above minimum wage. So it's a great job for the guy. He asks his parole officer. His parole officer says yes, but because his parole officer is not stupid, he doesn't go and ask permission up the chain, and he doesn't put it into the computer system, because by the time he gets that permission, the guy won't get the job. It'll take too long. So things are going fine. That parole officer switches out. Guy gets another parole officer. That's fine with that person. Third parole officer, it's fine. Fourth parole officer comes on board, and she doesn't talk to him. She just goes and knocks on the door of his home at 8 o'clock at night. He's not home. She issues a warrant for his arrest. He gets picked up, put into Rikers Island, and he's there for 6 weeks before they figure all this out and decide not to revoke him. He said to me, when I went into Rikers Island, I had a job, an apartment, a car, and a girlfriend. When I came out 6 weeks later, all of that was gone. I had to start all over again.
So another problem, this is so interesting to me, is that in many jurisdictions, one who is on probation or parole is not allowed to associate with people who have interactions with the criminal justice system. How does this affect some communities more than others?
So, you know, at the height of mass supervision, one out of 12 black men in America was on probation. Really an astonishing level of reach into a community by a probation system, and one out of three black men have a felony record. So it's really uniquely difficult for black men not to associate with other black men who have a felony record. I met a guy on a panel, again I was speaking, who was living in a homeless hotel because his mother had a felony record. She had a bedroom for him and he couldn't go home. Kerry Lathan comes out of prison on parole in California, in Los Angeles. While he was locked up, a musician, Nipsey Hussle, had donated clothing to Kerry's sister so that when Kerry came home, he had clothing. He comes out, he's going to a funeral, he goes to Nipsey Hussle's clothing store, Marathon Clothing, to buy a nice shirt to wear to the funeral. Nipsey Hussle's there, he goes over to thank him, and that's the moment when somebody assassinates Nipsey Hussle. So both Hussle gets killed and Kerry Lathan gets shot. Now Hussle was a big philanthropist and well-known in the Los Angeles area, so he was eulogized by President Obama and Los Angeles Mayor Garcetti. It was a 20,000-person event at a stadium in Los Angeles, and while all that's happening, Kerry Lathan's parole officer slaps a technical violation on him and moves him to jail in his wheelchair for associating with a known criminal, Nipsey Hussle, who had a prior record. One of the things you have to ask yourself is, why would a regular, normal person do something like this? Why would POs do these things? And it's important to not just think of the probation officers and parole officers. as uniquely mean people. They receive day after day very clear messages not to take any chances. If they take a chance on a guy like Kerry Layton, and Kerry Layton goes out and lives a happy, healthy, productive life, they get nothing for that. If they take a chance and something bad happens, they can get fired, they can get yelled at, they can get humiliated, transferred to a location they don't want to work in. One probation commissioner told me they used to keep a golden toilet bowl cover around their office that they would convey on the parole officer or probation officer who believed the story of one of their clients and was suckered in. So very clear messages not to take chances on people, which, you know, over time and writ large to 2,000 different departments around the country, can result in a lot of unnecessary and painful incarceration.
There's a term for this in the industry. It's called fear probation.
Yeah, that's when I did my tour, my staff were largely Black and Latino, and the people we were supervising were largely Black and Latino. And there was a lot of sort of anxiety over what we were essentially, you know, forcing them to do, which was to incarcerate other people who looked like them for non-criminal acts. And one of my POs during a listening session said, we practice fear probation here. We incarcerate people who look like us because if we don't and something goes wrong, you will throw us under the bus.
I hadn't realized, Vinny, that a lot of jurisdictions require people on probation and parole to pay at every visit with their officers for the supervision they are legally required to submit to. What is this about?
You know, when we launched our zeal for mass incarceration as a country, it really kind of came at the same time as we also launched efforts to dramatically cut back on taxation. And that had a number of effects. One part of it was we eliminated a lot of assistance to the very same people who we later incarcerated for a lot more money. That ranged from cash assistance on things like welfare to drug treatment to housing. And so there was less and less, fewer and fewer opportunities for people to succeed and more prisons to go to when they fail. We also didn't want to pay for this as a society. And so bit by bit, we started to pick their pockets to be part of this, you know, growing carceral system. And one of the ways that manifests itself is probation and parole. People have to pay to be on probation and parole. The same poor people who perhaps if they had enough money to pay for probation wouldn't have committed the crime in the first place. Some states have privatized big sections of their probation departments. Misdemeanor probation, for example, is very commonly privatized in Georgia, Alabama, Kentucky. One guy, Thomas Barrett, stole a $2 can of beer. He was a pharmacist, he became addicted to drugs, he lost his job, he lost his family, he lost his profession, and he hit the skids, stole a $2 can of beer, was ordered to pay a fine, didn't have the money to pay that fine, so got put on private probation where he accumulated $1,000 worth of fees for supervision, for electronic monitoring, for urine testing. They charged for all of that stuff, and finally just said, I can't do it anymore. He was selling his blood plasma, to pay to be on probation, and he just couldn't keep up. He fell $1,000 in arrear, and then ended up doing a year of jail for stealing a $2 can of beer and not being able to pay probation fees.
So how much are these fees? We're not talking, it sounds like, a $2 or $5 kind of pittance when you arrive. These can be expensive.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, no, they're expensive for people who actually have money, never mind for the, like, poor people that were on them. Barrett, I think, was paying like $30 a month, and then he gets fined $200 for stealing a beer, right? He says, I don't want a public defender, because he had to pay $50 for a full public defender. Then they put him on electronic monitoring. That's $12 a day, $39 a month to be on private probation. So that's about $400 a month. And this is a guy who's on subsidized rent. He's only paying $25 a month in rent. So like I said, he falls $1,000 behind in fees, which is 5 times his original court fine and 50 times the $2 can of beer.
Is it wrong, Vinny, for me to suspect that the people who are on probation and parole have been set up to fail in many jurisdictions?
Yeah, that sounds more active than I think it is. Elie Wiesel once wrote, the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference. Mm-hmm. I think this is a system that reeks of indifference. When I've talked to elected officials about this, they kind of have no idea. I'm not trying to say that they're blameless for that. I just think this thing is creeping around out there without a lot of people knowing about it, you know, kind of surveilling and punishing and harming this underclass of folks who's struggling with it. The guy on the panel with me who talked about, you know, losing his job and going to jail for 6 weeks at Rikers Island, the thing that most disturbed me about it, he wasn't even that upset about it. He basically said to me, I knew this system was going to screw me at some point. I thought it would be way worse than 6 weeks. He felt like he got off easy with only being in prison for 6 weeks for doing a job that he was referred to by his PO. So I think this is a group of folks, it's hard for some folks to relate to how frequently they get pushed around by systems like probation and parole. And I think that's happening without a lot of animus, if you will, without a lot of consciousness by most people, most elected officials, which is part of why I wrote the book.
Presumably, Vinny, being on probation or parole indicates somebody has been deemed less of a concern for committing future crimes or causing problems than somebody that is still locked up. This does not make it easier to, say, enroll in a community college or a university, even though almost everybody would think that's a great step forward for someone who has had trouble with the law.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what's happened over time. You know, again, imagine yourself as a PO. You've got 100, 150 people on your caseload, a very risk-averse environment. You don't have a lot of resources to help somebody go to college, find a place to live, find a job, get drug treatment. The one thing you have an infinite access to is prison. With a stroke of a pen, you can spend $50,000, $75,000 imprisoning somebody. But if you want to put somebody in college or housing or drug treatment, you have to run a bake sale, essentially, if you're a PO. So, you know, with so few resources and then so strung out with you know, 150 people on your caseload, sometimes POs, they do the wrong thing, not because they woke up that morning trying to harm somebody, but because in their world, that's the only thing they have easy access to.
I mean, does putting more people on probation and parole cut down on the numbers of people that we put into jails and prisons?
No, it hasn't been shown to do that. We did a 50-state, 40-year analysis, my colleagues and I, that I talk about, I write about in the book, of all the states. And we really tested the two questions that, you know, are the essential nub of what probation and parole are meant to do. Does this reduce crime, and does this reduce incarceration? And we found that there, the more people that are on probation and parole in a state, the more people that state is likely to have in prison when you control for other factors. And there was no relationship with the number of people on probation and crime, and there was actually a worsening relationship between parole and crime. The more people a state had on parole, the more violent crime that state had. So let's unpack that for a second. You're poor, you're struggling, you've come out of prison, you don't have a reliable place to live, you need a job, you have maybe a substance abuse problem, and all you're getting from a parole officer is hassles and a requirement to come sit in his office for a couple of hours a day. So bit by bit, we disrupt lives of people who are, in many cases, just hanging on by a thread. And that can lead them to engage in behaviors we really don't want them to engage in.
Vinny, I am neither on probation nor parole. If I am accused of stealing my neighbor's flower pots, and this goes all the way to court, and then I'm acquitted because I didn't do it, nothing else happens to me. I walk free. What might happen to me if I am on probation and parole, accused of that crime, and acquitted of it?
So when you go to court for that flower pot theft, you have the right to an attorney, you have the right to remain silent, you have the right to confront witnesses, and you have the right for the prosecutor to prove what you did beyond a reasonable doubt. If you were on probation, you would not have the right to an attorney, you would not have the right to confront witnesses, you would not have the right to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and you would not have the right to remain silent. So, for example, your neighbor could tell a police officer they thought it was you. That police officer could go to your revocation hearing and testify. You would not have the right to call your neighbor, nor would you have a lawyer to cross-examine them. And so based on the conversation your neighbor had with the police officer, they could revoke you and imprison you, even though you were acquitted in a court of law for that. That's not just true of a crime. That's true of a non-crime. So of leaving the county without permission or staying out past 7 o'clock at night, same thing. You don't have any of those rights, even if you're not accused of a crime and you're looking at going back to prison.
What you've just described sounds as if it violates a handful of constitutional provisions. How is that allowed under the Constitution?
The probation and parole were set up, as I mentioned earlier, to be a rehabilitative, helpful project. And so they're, interestingly, the major case law around them comes from the 1970s, before the advent of mass incarceration. And so the thought amongst the court was, this is like two friends helping each other. I'm helping you, Chris. I'm helping you kick your drug habit. I'm helping you stop stealing flower pots. I got to get in there and help you when the time comes. I got to be able to look through your underwear drawer to make sure you're not hiding drugs in there, which is why you stole that flower pot. We don't want the court in between me and your apartment. We want me to be able to just walk into that apartment, see what I see, do what I do. We don't want all this due process stuff slowing it down, because you're not fully free. You are not as free as everybody else if you're on probation and parole. So that was the theory behind it. It was kind of a quaint theory when we thought this was nothing but friendly. And remember, when the court was ruling this, they had fewer people in the whole prison system than we now send back to prison every year for technical violations of probation and parole. We send more people back just for these non-crimes every year than the whole prison population of 1972, when the leading cases around probation and parole were ruled upon by the U.S. Supreme Court. So it was a very, very different time.
What have you learned about how fears people have about being sent to prison on a technical violation affect the relationships between law enforcement in a given community and people on probation or parole?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at two neighborhoods, Philadelphia and Oakland, California, where there were very high levels, particularly of young men of color, under supervision, on probation, parole, out on bail, out on pretrial release. And at a certain point, when there's that much surveillance going on, it changes not just the nature of the relationship between an individual, between Vinny and a court system, but between the whole neighborhood and the court system. Because now it's not just me, Vinny, that doesn't have the right to keep a probation or parole officer out of my apartment, but my wife and kids don't either. So people can come walking into my apartment and they can look at things. And maybe I smoke pot, and maybe there's some marijuana on the coffee table in my living room. And now my wife is looking at losing control of her kids, because that's going to get reported to child welfare. Or maybe the guy that owns the corner store is sympathetic, because he knows I'm trying, and he knows I'm trying to kick my drug habit. So maybe he provides me with a plastic bag full of clean urine for me to bring into my probation office when I go get tested. So now all of a sudden, this guy is kind of drifting in to the criminal world in a way he wouldn't have otherwise done. So bit by bit, whole communities can feel and actually be surveilled in ways that it very directly flies against the goals that we're all trying to achieve, which is obviously more public safety. And that's what we saw in Philadelphia and Oakland in some of the more careful studies of those neighborhoods that ethnographers did.
Tell us about Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is the first city in the country to create, I guess, a purpose-built prison for people under community supervision who flunk out of that. What's been the fallout there?
Yeah, I mean, in Milwaukee, the number of people in one particular neighborhood, which is arguably the most incarcerated and surveilled zip code in the world, is that, you know, a stunningly high proportion of the black men in that neighborhood are under surveillance or in prison or in jail, a quarter of the folks. And they spent several $100 million, the state does, running a jail that's built in Milwaukee, just a few miles away from that heavily incarcerated zip code, just for people on technical parole and probation violations. It was the first in the whole country where they built a whole jail just to hold people who hadn't committed new crimes.
And so who is ending up? I mean, it seems like if you've got this jail, you're going to want to fill it in the same way that if you've got a hammer, you want to nail something.
Oh, yeah. And, one thing that happened right away was in some states, they can jail you while you're waiting to have your case resolved on a probation or parole violation. In Milwaukee and in the state of Wisconsin, you can put somebody in jail for 2 weeks until they have their hearing. The number of folks that got locked up that way, you know, during that 2 weeks, exploded. And then very often they would just drop the case on day 13, really just using that 2 week period as a way to sort of give you a little punishment by your PO that never had to go before a court.
All right, Vinny, we've talked about the ways these programs often fail to work as intended. The next obvious question is, are there alternatives?
Yeah, no, I think there are, and I think that's hopeful. There's more experimentation with alternatives. Some states have dramatically shortened the amount of time you can be under supervision. One interesting thing, I think, is basically saying to people, we'll give you 30 days off of supervision for every 30 days you don't get a technical violation. And the thing I like about that is it incentivizes a positive behavior rather than just focusing on punishing bad or undesirable behavior like staying out past curfew. And so it's a powerful motivator for people to get off supervision earlier. It's incredibly stressful to be under supervision. And so I think that's a good example. Some states have just straight up shortened the amount of time that you're under supervision. California just passed laws that shrunk probation and parole time to 2 years for felonies, 1 year for misdemeanors. New York did that as well. You could diminish the kinds of things that people can be locked up for. There's a law passed in New York that severely cut back on how long you could stay incarcerated for a technical violation, what kind of technicals you could get. Louisiana passed laws very, very much abridging how much time you can get, with the notion being that if you're going to give time, the most impactful thing is a short hit rather than a long period of time incarcerated. To my mind, all of these things save very quantifiable amounts of money. And what we need to do is at least capture a portion of that money and put it back into communities that have lots of people committing crimes in them, lots of people needing services, so that, you know, we can go back to where we used to be, which was trying to help people out that had run afoul of the law. So California has, when they reduced technical violations and reduced the amount of time you could be under supervision, literally returned hundreds of millions of dollars to their counties to buy victim services, to buy drug treatment services, and to buy mental health services for people who had run afoul of the law or who had been victimized. New York set up a whole network of community programs to help people, using in part the money they saved from not incarcerating so many people. So I think that all of those are viable. I also recommend experimenting with just eliminating supervision. There was not a piece of research I saw during the years that I wrote this book that shows that this is benefiting society. So could we experiment with and study carefully not having it? I was an expert on a private probation case in Giles County, Tennessee, where the state pays for a supervision on felony probation, but counties have to pay for it on misdemeanors probation. So Giles County had a private probation provider who was doing to the residents of Giles County what I described about Thomas Barrett. It was charging people a lot of money who were poor to be under supervision. A law firm sued. They used me as their experts. They won. And now there is literally no misdemeanor supervision in Giles County. If you go there for stealing that flower pot before a judge, the judge will order you to pay the flower pot back and write an apology letter and whatever else the judge thinks is appropriate and set another hearing date for 6 months from now. You come back and you report to the judge what you did. That's it. That's it. You don't have to hire a probation officer. You don't have to pay a private probation officer. They're not revoking you for staying out past 7 o'clock at night. All of that stuff is gone. And so people can live their lives. And if they don't do what the court tells them, they could be in trouble. And if they reoffend, they could be in trouble. But if they don't reoffend, importantly, they cannot be in trouble, which is what's happening with people on probation and parole.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying here. I think a lot of people assume that even if the rules are draconian and unfortunate, that checking in with a probation or parole officer is a big part of what keeps people on the straight and narrow, either in avoiding incarceration or at the end of incarceration. You're saying there's not a lot of evidence that spending time in the parole or probation system prevents future crimes. Either they're going to happen or they're not.
I think that there are things that can prevent future crimes. I saw no evidence that meeting with a parole or probation officer was one of those things. I think drug treatment is great. I think victim offender reconciliation is great. There's evidence that those are the kinds of things that help. Seeing a PO, no evidence. No evidence. So we spend a lot of money on a thing with no evidence. In fact, several of the gurus of the evidence-based practice world, James Bonta, Ed Letessa, basically have concluded probation and parole are not an evidence-based practice. I think they exist predominantly tomorrow because they existed yesterday. It's a very powerful status quo. I think people don't think about this enough, and therefore they don't innovate in this space. I think this is a space that cries out for innovation, where we're wasting a tremendous amount of money to mess with people's lives without a lot of outcomes to show for it.
Vincent Schiraldi is founder of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice and the Justice Policy Institute. His book is called Mass Supervision, Probation, Parole, and the Illusion of Safety and Freedom. Vinny, thanks very much for the conversation.
Thanks so much for having me on, Chris. This is a really great discussion.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and get the podcast wherever you'd like to get your podcasts, or look for it at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Wow. Yeah. I listened to this once before, and that was just full of stuff that is shocking and terrifying. What'd you guys think? Thumbs up. All right, we've had a lot of good comments in the chat on the side. John, you had a lot of good comments. You wanna raise your hand and share some of them out loud? I'm unmuting you.
Good evening, everybody. Before I get started on some of these comments, I just want to call your attention to, and I'm making a shameless plug for my radio show for next week. I've already put the information in the chat. I've talked with a number of individuals, and the speaker this evening, like so many others, not just here, but that I've met and talked with and had on my program, the one thing I would say, other than perhaps direct experience, the one thing that they have in common is that they have the research, and I'm putting it as fact, not fact-based, but fact-founded research, peer-reviewed research, evidence-driven research. The sad thing is that we've got a lot of politicians. Now, some of them probably very sincerely believe that we are in a high crime atmosphere, a high crime situation. And in one of the comments, one of our highly esteemed, but not by me, senators, Tom Cotton, has basically said on multiple occasions, what's wrong with the American criminal justice system is that we don't have enough people locked up.
It's hard to imagine anybody buying that. Like when you compare the United States, when you compare the United States to basically almost every other country, to find countries that lock up more people than the United States, there's no first world countries on that list.
No. And in fact, let me see. Rutgers University several years ago did a study on the impact of fear. And it was, again, it was peer reviewed. It was researched. And believe it or not, there are some people out there that to them, fear becomes an addiction, just like gambling, just like looking at online porn or alcoholism, that fear can, for some individuals, be an addiction. And the, let me see, there was one reference in that study, I remember, and it had to do fear of the sex offender who moves into your neighborhood. And the fact was brought up that the fear of the sex offender in the neighborhood was, well, the only thing that people might fear most is that there is someone in the neighborhood who is not on the list and is going around doing the dirty to so many people. And it was just really something that that a lot of people find themselves caught in this kind of addiction, this form of addiction. And media, the study, not just this one, but so many of the studies, media thrives on the old thing, if it bleeds, it leads, or bad news sells best, because that's what gets our attention.
Yep.
Okay. When I lived and worked overseas, there's a lot that I have forgotten. But one day in my own backyard, I had an up close and very personal encounter, and I'm not making this up, with a black cobra. When you have one of the world's deadliest snakes raised up, hood spread, ready to strike, and you're only a couple of feet away from it, that's something you don't forget. That's a fear that stays with you. Okay. Media for clickbait, for advertising dollars, push, 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 push. Get the fear, get the fear, get the scare, get the people scared. Get them, get them, get them. Oh, 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 what do we do? What do we do? There's someone who's got an answer. And we turn, yeah, and we turn to try to get the answer. But how many times is the answer not complete?
Yeah. All right, I see Jeannie. Jeannie has her hand up. I'm going to unmute you, Jeannie. Ask me your question.
Oh, it's not a question. Comment, I just wanted to point out that Schiraldi's book is really good. It has a lot of stuff that you know, people are really unaware of. But the thing that I noticed in the book is that it does not include anything about the registry. And so he says there are 4 million people under supervision in the United States. And if you were to add the, you know, whatever we're estimating now, around 1 million, I suppose, maybe more, I don't know, on the registry, if we would add them to the list of people who live under some kind of supervision, it would be, I think that was a real failing in the book, that he doesn't recognize that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the book is great.
It's I just completely that, agree.
Yeah.
I want to share my screen. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Sorry, I dropped another book recommendation in the chat. What's Prison For? It's written by Bill Keller, who was the first editor for the Marshall Project. And I hope everybody follows the Marshall Project. It's a really good journalism source. Anyhow, What's Prison For is a small book, and I recommend it to everybody because it's a small book, but it is packed with all kinds of facts about prison. And it also has a chapter in there about registrants. So in that book, we are not forgotten.
Ah, didn't leave us out. That's good. All right, I found this thing on the internet here. It says, this is the rates, world incarceration rates if every U.S. state was a country, right? So look how far down we have to go before we find any other country on the state on this list. El Salvador, Turkmenistan, Rwanda, Cuba, Thailand, Panama, Costa Rica. Like, how far do we have to go before we find a country that we even remotely consider to be a peer of ours who incarcerates as many people as we do? I haven't found one yet. You know, we like to believe we're better than the rest of the world. I mean, I literally, what, Poland? So the idea that we should incarcerate more people is just insane. You know, okay, we're finally down to the United Kingdom, Scotland. Look how far down on this list we went. It's just outrageous. All right, I'm going to unshare the screen. I put that link in the chat. How many of us are going to the NARSL conference this weekend? Yeah, Beverly, good, good. And I think I saw somebody at the very beginning said he was going to be there. He might have left when he realized it was the different speaker. But I will be there. Looking forward to seeing Beverly. Yeah. Anyway, if we don't have more discussion we want to have about this particular book, I love this book that you recommended, Jeannie. I'll put.
Have
that
you
on.
Read it?
I have not. Okay. I've added it to the list.
I am curious, though. I have another question, or I guess my first question. How many in this group have read the book that Shiraldi's book?
I've not. I listened to the interview, but I haven't read it.
Yeah. I just think that sometimes people who are worried about the registry, we get so focused on the registry that we forget that the registry people are not the only ones who suffer in this criminal justice system. Anybody in prison suffers, and we should be reading books about the general
absolutely
picture of criminal justice.
And not only that, but you know, I think our way out, our way forward is not just staying in our little bubble, but working with people who are working on the other things, you know,
right.
Sitting at the table with the people who are working on, you know, this and that, you know, rehabilitation efforts.
Yes.
Because when we sit around their table and help them with their project, several things happen. Number one, they start to see us as real people, right?
Yes.
Instead of the scary bad guy that we cut out of the thing at the end of the day. And number two, if we're there working with them on their topics, they're less likely to, you know, cut us out at the last minute, like right. They did in Florida when they did working on getting people's right to vote back, and they, you know, they left us off because we weren't there. So I think that's, you know, not that we don't have plenty to do on our own, but I think pairing up with organizations that are doing things that are not just for people in the registry sounds like a great idea. All right, John.
That's why I raised my hand. I wanted to share with you that I've been in touch with, and I've been working with several groups along those lines. And just for your information, just for a few of them, there's Decarcerate. There's Families Against Mandatory Minimums, the National Incarceration Association.
Wait, you're talking too fast. Families okay. Against Mandatory Minimums.
The
I'm
National,
writing them in the list.
National Incarceration Association, working with the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And I think there's someone on there. I don't know if I'm going to get the reaction. Maybe I'm thinking about a different person. But there's an organization called CURE, Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Air.
Hi, Charlie.
I got the response I was looking for. CURE.
Citizens, say it again.
These are just a few organizations. And don't stop with just people in other groups that are working for reforming the system. Try to work with victims' rights groups. Try to work with victims' advocacy groups. Just to give you an example, there's a group here in Arkansas, and they are finally willing to go so far as to anyone who has wound up on a sex offense registry as a result of a false accusation should be considered a crime victim. Now, that is a pretty good step in the right direction, but it takes time. It takes talking. And this is, you know, just what you've been talking about. It takes time. It takes sitting down, putting a face to what you're trying to do, telling story.
Well, and of course, you know, anybody who's been incarcerated, anybody who's struggling with the same kind of struggles that we're struggling with, you know, we're putting them in a situation where it's very hard for people to have extra time or extra money or extra just the, you know, we've filled them up with all kinds of awful things that you got to do. And then expecting people to have extra time to like give their, you know, volunteer for these other groups or, you know, donate to these organizations, you know, we've made it impossible. And I'm, you know, I'm guessing that this is the way the system was designed, right? The Southern strategy, that was the point, right?
Politics.
Michael Harris.
Politics. Oh, politics. And now, if this would help any of you, now on, you've heard me talk about how I came up with a test your, and state specific, if you will, test your sex offender knowledge quiz. Well, a year or so ago, I got a simulation game, if you will, a simulation project from a U.S. district attorney in Delaware. This was a simulation, a role-playing project where people were brought in to take on the persona of someone who was being released from prison, whether it was at the finish of the sentence or probation or parole. And of course, it was set up to be as realistic as possible. There was a target group that was brought into this project. And I had several conversations with this U.S. district attorney who put this project together. And she said that every one of the target audience failed. If they had been inmates, they would have been back behind bars before the technical month was up. What surprised me was that every single one of these individuals who were brought in to this simulation were prosecuting attorneys.
Wow.
She sent me the project. She sent me the simulation. The big thing, of course, is paper. The big expense is going to be paper. But I not only have that test your sex offender knowledge quiz, but I've got a copy. It may be a little outdated, but I have a copy. It's all in a PDF of this simulation. And again, if anyone would like a copy of this simulation, please email me. I'm going to put my email address in the chat right now.
Yeah, I'd love to both see that and take your test your knowledge.
Okay. Send me your email. I'll be glad.
Yeah, my email, but yes, I will.
I'll send that to you. I'll send it to you. The
wow.
I don't have a link, but I've got it. I've got the PDF of it. That's why I'm saying send me your email address and I'll send it to you.
Okay. All right. Michael, you're up.
Hello. I'm out watering my garden, so my connection may be a little weird. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, I just wanted to say that, you know, because our organization in Indiana is pretty small, that's one thing we've been doing is working with other local organizations that are nationally affiliated, one of which is CURE, actually set on the board of directors for Indiana CURE too, and then Reform Alliance, which was started by a couple of rappers, Jay-Z and Meek Mill, and they've got quite a bit of money behind them, and they've created quite an alliance of organizations here in Indiana, so I'm able to tap into those other organizations to kind of get the word out about what we're doing, but also to know like where to send people for housing or, you know, some kind of services or whatever when they contact us. So, yeah, it really is important, especially if you're a smaller organization, to be able to tap into those people. And then I was going to say that I'm actually working with a gentleman out of Virginia who is running a film festival in Virginia called the In Thrive Film Festival, which is features films that are made by or have someone who has been formerly incarcerated heavily involved in the production of the film. And we're actually bringing it to Indiana as well next year. So those are some things that you can do as well.
Yeah, and thank you, Michael, for your response to my that. That's honestly one of the main things I do is just, you know, I take calls and emails from people who are looking for something in a state. And of course, I can't memorize all the things in all the states. So when someone asks me for something in Indiana, I pull up my list of people I know in Indiana. And, if, you know, luckily there's somebody I know on there. But I tend to just put everybody I know in that state in the blind copy. And then I type in, you know, whatever the person's looking for. And, you know, honestly, most of the time, one of you answers and hooks that person up with something in their state. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about all of you. You seem to be very willing to help other people. All right, Michael, you're outside, so you don't see the list. Can I give Jeannie your email? She says she knows someone who lives in Indiana who asked me for a contact in Indiana. Michael?
He's watering.
He's busy. He's very busy watering. I'm going to assume that he's going to say yes to this and that he's no longer listening. Does that seem reasonable? Okay. I'm sending you Michael's address.
Thank you.
Okay. Arkansas Registrant has put a list of help organizations. Oh, actually, I have that one. I've used that several times, that help yourself directory. And yeah, that'd be really nice if we had that in every state. If we had that in every state, my job would be much easier.
Well, I put that up there that if you're not familiar with it, this is the first year that the Help Yourself directory has been online, and you can access it. And in accessing, there's a color bar on the lower left-hand corner of a number of the pages. If you click on that color bar, that will automatically download a PDF of that particular edition.
Yeah, and I've used it several times, and I've sent it to people who contact me who are living in Arkansas.
Well,
yeah, that'd be really nice if we had that in every state.
Well, again, that's why I put it up there, and I've made a follow-up comment. See if you can get groups in your area to do something similar.
Yeah, that's quite good. So, Charles, I would love you to tell us something or share something you know, because you started this organization. How long ago did you do that?
Well, it's been over 50 years. I started when I was 30, and my wife was about that age, 30. And we're in our mid-80s. And, well, you wonder if you've made any progress. But I think that we're also not only working in the United States, but we have attempts at trying to have some type of a world, the five continents, try to have members in each continent. And then to go through the United Nations and try to reach out to them and see if we can lower the crime rate and also lower the number of people in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're doing. And we're at a point where we're about ready to retire. And so we want to find somebody who is younger, a lot younger, who will take over.
Wow. Yeah, my dad is 85, I think. He does a totally different thing. He's a botanist. But what he's been doing in the last like 3 or 4 years is traveling the continent, trying to find people to take over what he does for a living, which is one kind of plant. It's when you care a lot about your work.
Yeah,
that's important.
I remember when John interviewed me in, it's been what, 10 years at least, huh?
Give or take.
Yeah, so it was good.
Well, thank you for your 50 years of service. Well, you know, I wish 50 years had made a big difference and we could say, everything's great now.
And Charles, I've been talking to Wayne Bouts, and I put the word out, not only for him to tell you hello, but to find out if you want to make another visit on my program. But I hadn't heard anything back as yet.
Oh, okay. Well, Wayne would be interviewed?
He has been, but we were talking about someone by the name of Charles.
Oh yeah. Okay. Sure. Okay. Okay, John. Yeah.
Oh, and there's another person by the name of Ann who's going to be back on my program. In a few weeks.
One of these days. Oh, yeah. I don't know. I always want to believe that we're making progress. Honestly, they've gone so over the top, and the fact that every kid these days has a phone right while they're going through puberty, I think is going to be, it's already shown to be pretty dangerous for children. I can't remember which one of our members, but one of our members did a survey in her state. She went through the entire registry and she sorted people by what year they were, how old they were when they got put on the registry. And guess was the tallest line on the survey, the age at which more people had committed their crime was 17. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just a matter of time before they go too far. And, you know, I just want to believe that things are going to change and they're going to get so many people on this registry that people are going to stand up and
yeah.
just make the most of it.
And there's
all right. Well, thank you, everybody.
You too.
2 weeks from now, we will have our conversation about civil commitment with Thaisa and temporarily blanking on his name. I've lost it. Anyway, I'm going to remind you all how to save the chat because there's a lot of good stuff on there. So remember, if you have the chat open on the right-hand side at the top, it'll have three little dots. So click on that dot, 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 and then choose save chat. And that will let us let you have access to all the great comments and the emails and all the things. And John's email, if you want to send John an email to volunteer to come on his show or to ask for his
information.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for coming. I apologize for the last minute change-a-roo, but you know, you can't help that sometimes. And I'll see you all in 2 weeks on July 2nd. And see some of you in Atlanta in a few days. Oh, Mark, you got your hands up. Hey, Mark.
Oh, just clapping. Good job.
Oh, okay.
I think if I could add before y'all hop off,
yes, please.
I think the only thing I keep hearing, like, victim this, add this, or hold on, I feel weird not looking at y'all. Can y'all see me? I never hear much about getting attorneys because I'm on the registry and I work at a law firm and I do contract work with other lawyers, you know, whether it's criminal defense, civil rights. And I've slowly have been getting them to change their paradigm like you did with me, Anne, and have me have a different outlook on it to where they're helping them. Because attorneys got to do pro bono work each year and they got to report it to their state bar. But I never hear anything of, hey, let's reach out to these attorneys. Like, obviously we have the Innocence Project. I mean, we're not going to get them on board, but is there any groups or any local attorneys that we can reach out to that can start helping restore rights or helping challenge the legal precedents of, you know, the sex offender registry and basically fight that it is cruel and that it is an unusual punishment. Basically to go after the Supreme Court ruling that said, hey, this is not a cruel or unusual punishment. The registry does not do this, 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 this. But here in Virginia, side note, it was cruel and unusual for someone to have 5 DUIs to have a red license plate. That's cruel. But for somebody to have a sex crime that was committed 30 years ago, all that information is public knowledge, which basically and y'all get what I'm saying. So,
yeah, I would love to have an attorney on. I actually had an attorney who told me, oh, yeah, he was willing to come on. But then when I followed up and said, OK, well, which of these days would you come on? He'd kind of dropped that. But I could try asking him again. And honestly, you have lawyer friends. So if anybody has a lawyer friend that they think they'd be willing to come on and talk to us.
I can reach out.
I'll try my guy again. I know the biggest thing is lawyer.
Because I know the biggest thing is like for me, mine was federal because I was in the military. So I can never petition for my gun rights ever again, unless it is a presidential pardon. As of the 1991 Act for the FTA. Am I saying that right? FTA, firearms, tobacco, alcohol. Yeah. So that's another thing. If you have any, you know, sex crimes that were charged federally, they can never petition it because the federal government has said with court precedents that as long as they do not deny you, then there's no denial. So you cannot petition the federal court in itself. So then that would require you, your only last resort is a presidential pardon. So then you're stuck there.
I gotta say how weird it is seeing your face because we've talked on the phone so many times. That's not the face that my brain put in there.
Oh, I'm sorry. 10 years in the military, I got bad genetics.
No, it's a great face. It's just not the face my brain memorized.
Yeah, well, that's like imagine, I scared the new secretary with my tattoos at the office. She's like, who are you? I'm like, I work here. But no, I think that's the biggest thing for me is I keep hearing, you know, let's push the, you know, push the victim, push the victim. We got to reach out there. Well, I'm on the registry and I won't put my 4-year-old daughter in the public limelight for people to attack her. You know, I have to think about my kids because, you know, I have a son in Alabama, which Alabama has the harshest sex offense laws. I have a court document from a judge in Alabama that says I can go to a school there to pick up my son. I think the biggest thing is that we got to push to change the court precedents to, I guess not really change it, but we need to be pushing the court to make these changes so that way we have court precedents to then go attack it. I think I know John hit on it, and then the interview hit on it was the Civil Rights Act. I mean, they harped and harped and harped in, you know, the 70s and 80s for those civil rights so that way we didn't lose our civil rights. And I think we need to basically attack the registry with the Civil Rights Act and basically say, hey, this is unconstitutional, that this is cruel and unusual punishment, but we need lawyers. And I think that's like the hardest part. Like, I have one guy that would probably talk on it because he does a lot of criminal. But I mean, I'm just,
we'll start
I'm
asking a small around. Term. Let's talk tomorrow.
Okay, I will.
All right, John.
Just a couple of things. Narsol, I'm not so, I correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I don't know so much about war, but Narsol has been a presence at several of the, over the last few years, of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers convention. Yeah. And so that's one way that they've been establishing contact. So talking with the NACDL is one thing. It was recently brought up by another group I was attending a meeting, and you were talking about people to maybe do pro bono work. Well, the suggestion was to approach the students at a law school to see if they could be doing their pro bono work by doing the research into these various areas.
Yeah, you could, as long as it's not unauthorized practice of law.
And the other thing, let me see, my train of thought jumped the tracks, would be to get, oh, yes. You were talking about civil rights. There's been a very great deal of talk amongst a number of groups that I'm aware of and have been working with. And they say civil rights, going at it on the civil rights, is a really, really good thing from the point of view of three perspectives: women's rights, minority rights, LGBTQ rights.
Well, honestly, it's very clear.
Borrow the methods, the techniques, the research, everything from at least these three civil rights movements.
I would agree.
NARSOL does have, they have lawyers that come every, well, at least they had two lawyers there last year talking about all the cases that they had fought with the registry, you know, winning things for the registry. So maybe I'll look on my last year's list and see if I can get either of those lawyers.
I mean, that would have been good like 2 years ago to go after it that way, just because, I mean, in the secular society of the current presidential administration, you probably could have worked it, and the Supreme Court justices in there now, that they're more likely to sway to the left side. I mean, I don't see that if I'm not, you hit on it. The whole registry is politically driven. It is to scare the society into, hey, we need to do this. I will do this. Give me votes. I don't see that happening in the Trump administration or a Republican administration, just because they're trying to secure those votes. But I think I definitely agree with you on the civil rights aspect, but I think we need more of a secular leftist, you know, democratic government that would be willing to say, hey, this is a group of minorities. They are wrongfully, you know, what's like this newer generation and age. I think all of us, I don't know if I'm the youngest, but I mean, I'm in my 30s and I cannot stand kids these days. Or what was it, the Gen X or the Gen Zs that say, oh, well, I got an opinion. Well, yeah, dude, you're out protesting. I'm at work, you know? All of us are normally got 9-to-5 jobs. We're at working while they're out protesting.
Everybody pro, like you have to, I don't begrudge the younger generation their You know, because when you first get old enough to notice how shitty things are around you, it's protesting is important, and you know, this whole Israel, this whole Israel Palestine fight is like, it's this generation's Vietnam. It's the thing that's like riling them up and making them stop and think like, that's not right. We should protest. I don't begrudge them that. I think that that's good for kids.
It's so easy to protest, but think about this, that wonderful line from a film that I saw some years ago. I know what you are against, the character said, but what are you for?
Very true statement.
I know what you are against, but what are you for?
Yeah. All right. I love you guys. Thank you for sharing all of your awesome ideas and questions and so on. It's 8:33. I want to respect everybody's time. I will see you in 2 weeks for Thaisa Carvalho Mick's conversation about civil commitment facilities. And I will work on getting us, Mark, call me tomorrow and let's work on finding a lawyer that might be willing to come on.
Okay.
I've got a couple of good ideas.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, everybody.